Hey everybody, welcome to episode 59 of Literary Disco, Pancake Story. We begin today's episode with a... Yeah.
In this episode, we talk about our favorite breakfast.
Right. No, today we will begin with a Classics Corner with two Ks, a segment in which Todd will write a fake passage to a classic work of literature and try and fool me and Julia into believing it's real. And then we will dive into the short stories of Brees DJ Pancake. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me are essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel and novelist and critic Todd Goldberg.
Good evening.
Hi, everybody.
Good, very late night for me. It's 11 o'clock.
Yes. If Julia sounds weird, it's because she has pounded coffee all day so that she could do this show on Eastern Standard Time. What? Or is it Daylight Savings?
Daylight Savings is not a time zone. That's a twice-a-year experience.
Well, it's Eastern Standard, and then if it's...
Daylight Savings makes no sense. It's really a ridiculous tradition that we should just drop, because it's just confusing.
Shouldn't it always be Daylight Savings time?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, isn't it nicer for it to be light outside, you know, longer?
You know, I think it's...
This hurts my brain to think through, but...
Yeah, I know. We are stumped. For the first time, we're totally stumped.
Okay. As far as I understand it, daylight savings was started so people would... So shops would still be open during daylight hours, so people would shop longer.
No,
because
I thought
otherwise,
it had to do with the war.
No, it's for farmers.
It was about the war.
It's farmers.
And
wow.
Farmers.
So we all have completely different ideas. I heard that it was... I heard that it was about farmers originally, but then I read something somewhere that said that it was because... It was trying to increase commerce in America, like, but it's an American thing. It's not like it has no basis in actually adjusting for seasons or science. It's just commerce or farming.
The modern era of daylight savings was first proposed in 1895 by George Vernon Hudson, and it was first implemented. By Germany and Austria-Hungary, starting on. The 30th of April, 1916.
Sounds like war.
Many countries, I know, many countries have used it various times since. Most particularly since the energy crisis of the 1970s. So it doesn't have anything to do with war.
Or farmers.
Huh.
Or
farmers.
Shopping. Wow. Does Germany still use daylight savings time?
Let's see here. So it does have something to do with war. So in 1916, Germany and its allies were the first to use daylight savings time as a way to conserve coal during wartime. So it is a Nazi, they weren't Nazis in 1916. Whatever they were in 1916, it was their weird little thing.
They were a new country.
It became...
They were a pretty new country. They were figuring out their shit.
Pre-Nazi.
You know.
Russia and a few other countries waited until the next year, and the United States adopted it in 1918.
Wow. I thought we won that war.
But yeah.
Guess not.
Or we just absorbed the ideas.
Sounds like...
At any rate, it's quite late where Julia is, but it's still light where Ryder and I happen to be.
Putting me somewhere in the Austro-Hungarian... Empire.
Hey, let me ask you guys an important question before we get on to the important literary game playing. Are you guys watching the World Cup?
A little bit. It's too sad. I really hate sports where everyone is sad 50% of the time. It's awful.
Well,
somebody's got to lose. What do you mean? Anytime you're playing.
That's all sports.
Just the level of disappointment is really brutal.
Yes, Todd, I've been watching. I haven't watched the last... Last 2 days, so I missed the Germany blowout, and so I've missed a couple things. But I mean, I watched all the USA games. That was
the USA games were amazing, and Tim Howard was amazing. But
yes.
I was watching it today, which today was the Netherlands versus Argentina, which ended in a shootout. And here's my question. It might be related to the daylight savings times thing. When is the Netherlands, and when is the Netherlands Denmark?
Never.
Denmark. It's never Denmark.
Oh, Holland. No. Holland. I'm sorry.
You're an idiot.
When is Sweden Switzerland? At what point do we say Iceland is Greenland? Never. Okay,
but it has two names.
I know what you're saying.
I can't.
But it's also, think about it this way. It's comparable to Great Britain, United Kingdom, England. Right?
Right.
They're all different categories. There are technical definitions. So I think, and you know, of course, the Netherlands, they have their own name for their country in their own Dutch language. So
right. Something with a lot of
I'm not sure what that is. That's probably the most accurate. But for English, I don't know why we call it the Netherlands and Holland. I'm not sure either.
I don't understand that.
Julia, do you have any ideas?
No, I can't. When is the Netherlands Denmark?
But let's break down England right now, because I feel like we could do that.
The answer is, I don't know.
When is the United Kingdom refers to everything that's under the crown, which is all
Wales.
Including Canada, Wales, including
Wales,
Australia.
Ireland.
Like, that's all part of the United Kingdom,
I think? Australia isn't part of the United Kingdom.
They don't believe in the royal family. They don't care about that. They used to be. They were a penal colony of the United Kingdom.
But not anymore.
Okay, but hold on. But there are countries that are Commonwealth. Canada's a Commonwealth.
Right, but
the United
Australia
Kingdom.
Is not a Commonwealth.
Australia is not. Okay.
No.
Good to know. So are they not part of the United Kingdom then?
No.
Okay.
Australia's its own thing.
Well, then
just like,
Great Britain
just
includes
like the African
Scotland
countries that,
and Ireland, debatable, North, South Ireland. Great Britain. That's what that... But then what is England referred to? Just the country...
Just the country of England, I believe.
Just the country of England.
I think Great Britain and England are interchangeable, and I believe Holland and the Netherlands are also interchangeable.
See, I would assume that Scotland would be included in Great Britain.
Well, we should ask our friend Sheena. I think she'd have some opinions on that matter.
Yeah.
Huh. I can't believe we don't know this. I'm a little embarrassed.
I know, it's a little embarrassing, but at
but
any
they
rate...
they spell things with extra U's over there.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Well, and then there's the whole legalized marijuana in Amsterdam, so there's all that I think affects people's ability to say things correctly. But at any rate...
Okay, guys.
Yes?
I have some information.
Okay.
The Netherlands used to include Belgium, but when Belgium became independent... the Netherlands just continued to use the name. Oh, today the Kingdom of the Netherlands encompasses the Netherlands, one constituent country of the kingdom, Aruba, and a couple other islands here.
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, so like when that guy, Vandersloot, murdered that woman, that girl, on Aruba, he escaped back to Holland?
Holland.
Okay. Huh. And then he killed that other woman somewhere else and got convicted of that. Hmm.
All right. None of this has anything to do with literature.
Well, I just wanted to talk about how awesome the World Cup is from a narrative standpoint, because I have been watching it, and never is there more drama than in a 0-0 game. You know, it's just really fraught. And so I wanted to recommend a great book about soccer called Kick and Run, by Jonathan Wilson, that I actually reviewed for the LA Review of Books a couple months ago. And it's about really being a young Jewish kid in England and becoming and playing soccer, and how that soccer was the one democratic unifying thing in the place where he lived. That it was the one thing that pulled people of all races, colors, and creeds together was their time on the pitch.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's a really interesting book. It follows him from his childhood all the way up until present day, where he's a journalist and a novelist as well. And he actually wrote about the World Cup for The New Yorker when it was in Chicago, which I believe was 1996 or 2002, something like that. But if you're interested in soccer and the World Cup specifically, I recommend the book Kick and Run by Jonathan Wilson. A good book. So
sounds good.
It is good. So we're bringing back an old game. We haven't played this one in quite some time. And people, they love the Classics Corner. Julia, can you explain what Classics Corner is?
Okay. Well, we won't refer to it like this anymore, but its full name is Classics Corner with two Ks. So, yeah, Todd just sent us an email spelled K-L-A-S-S, etc., with two Ks in the title. It's really exciting. It's cute. You know, if you lived in a small town... that's how they would spell it. So how it works is Todd has chosen a passage. One, right?
No, there's one fake passage and two real passages.
One fake and two real. Okay, there are two real passages and one fake passage that Todd has written from a famous piece of literature. And he's going to read them out loud, and we also have them in front of our eyes. And then Ryder and I have to guess which one Todd made up.
All right. You guys ready?
Yeah. So do we get to know what the book is?
Yes. This is from The Death of Ivan Illich. So it's actually a short story. The Death of Ivan Illich by Tolstoy.
Didn't you do a Russian last time? I feel like... Who did Dostoevsky?
I might have done Dostoevsky.
You love the Russians.
Was like that was like a year and a half ago.
When you do your classics, you go right for Russians. Interesting.
I do. I do like
and
the
Russians.
And yet you
Russian
hate
literature. Russians. True. And you hate Russia. So
I hate Russia because they chased
the
my 80s. Family out in the early 1900s. And then they killed all the Jews in that city where they lived. Okay. So... I got my issues with Russia. Don't get me started on Germany either. Okay, so this is The Death of Ivan Illich. It's a wonderful short story by Tolstoy. Here is example number one. Ivan Illich found time in the provinces a constant tide of drudgery, like a disease of the kidneys where there is no warning but death. It was to be 1881, his son long past, his daughter struck with the silence of education and then life. And then marriage of her own. His tasks were few now. It was the worry, the uncommon refusal of contempt to leave him at will. He could see the markings Peter the footman had left in his wake. That was all there ever might be. All right? That's number one.
Sounds
number two.
Fake.
Number two. Neither as a boy nor as a man was he a toady. But from early youth was by nature attracted to people of high station, as a fly is drawn to the light, assimilating their ways and views of life, and establishing friendly relations with them. All the enthusiasms of childhood and youth passed without leaving much trace on him. He succumbed to sensuality, to vanity, and latterly among the highest classes to liberalism, but always within limits, which his instinct unfailingly indicated to him as correct. That's number two. And number three, always the same, now a spark of hope flashed up, then a sea of despair rages, and always pain, always despair, and always the same. When alone, he had a dreadful and distressing desire to call someone, but he knew beforehand that with others present, it would be still worse. Another dose of morphine, to lose consciousness. I will tell him, the doctor, that he must think of something else. It's impossible, impossible to go on like this.
Mm. Wow.
Mm. Yes.
Okay. I certainly think the second one is really Tolstoy.
I do too.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's no doubt in my mind about that. So.
Yeah.
It being one of the most famous passages Tolstoy has ever written, I would suggest it is. That is correct.
Is it really? I don't actually recognize it for
don't,
that reason.
Yes.
Don't
just the...
help us.
I'm sorry.
But yeah, you're right. You just made your job harder.
Let me add another one.
here are some of the clues. You know, assimilating. That's a very Tolstoyan concept and word to use. And then highest classes to liberalism. All of that is that woven
just
in
the
with
word
the emotional.
Toady too is so not. Tired.
Yeah, yeah.
I've
latterly among the highest classes to liberalism.
Ugh. Let's get down to brass tacks here. I think the first one's total bullshit.
You don't believe in Tolstoy? You believe he's a bullshit writer?
Don't try to trick me.
I'm not talking.
Yeah, just don't talk. Just give us 2 minutes apiece. Right.
The third one sounds the most it's more repetitive. Always the same. Always pain, always despair. So, which makes me think it could be Todd vamping a little. Mm-hmm. Like, I need to fill a little bit more space because there's more repetition in that one.
See,
it's impossible, impossible to go on like this. But I've never read the story, or if I did, it's been so long that I don't remember what it's about. So that none of this is familiar enough. Like, is that first one, does it refer to the character with his full name? Is that like a...
Yeah, I think...
A pattern
That doesn't throw me off. I think, so I picked up on the same repetitiveness as you did, Ryder, and also, I just don't think that Todd would say things like, a sea of despair rages, because that sounds pretty corny and cliche, and I think he wouldn't try to do that. I think he's a lot more likely to try to say something like a disease of the kidneys. That sounds like Todd to me.
You are good. You are good. I'm going to vote number one based on what Julia said. Number one is clearly Todd. You're right. You're right. He would catch himself in cliche on number three. But number one, he's trying to sound, yeah, no, that's good. And he also threw in the date and the full name. So
he thought
like
that
to reemphasize that it's the 19th century. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number one.
His
totally Todd.
Were few you now? Yeah, I don't know.
And Peter the footman? Like, why are we learning about a footman? just because Todd wanted to throw in the word footman. Yeah. No.
Well, you guys are correct. Yeah. Number one. The real clue should have been that I misspelled Ivan Illich's last name in the thing I sent you. it's supposed to be Illich.
Well, I noticed that, but sometimes there's different spellings of Russian surnames, so... Yeah.
Well, you know, you are correct. The like a disease of the kidneys, that was a line that I was like, oh, I want it to be similar to the fly going to the light, but different. and then there's a, you know, he's dying throughout the story. If you've never read it, it's a wonderful, awful short story. And there is a bit where he's complaining about the kidneys. And then I was like, but that is so true about the kidneys. You don't know until it takes you. Peter the footman is a character in the story. And there is a line in the story where it says he dies in the year 1880, if memory serves me correct. And so there's a bit in there where it says it was 1880. So I was like, oh, I will bump it up a year. It's now 1881, motherfuckers.
Okay. Can I issue a listener challenge?
Yes.
Because I think, like, a disease of the kidneys is just so captivating. I would like our listeners to tweet us the end of that sentence. Complete that metaphor. What? Like a disease of the kidneys, ... And we will read the best ones next time.
Yeah.
I love that idea. Like a disease of the kidneys, ...
Jesus.
Although... I will say, like a disease of the kidneys where there is no warning but death. Not a bad line.
Not a bad line.
Not a bad line. I don't have any use for it, but not a bad line. Well, that was Classics Corner with 2 Ks. And once again, I present the clues to Ryder and Julia. And once again, week after week, they get me right away. At least it wasn't fucking Freedom and you guys figured it out.
I feel like actually Classics Corner, we've all been stumped except for my first one. I think you guys got nailed me on the first one, but other than that, we've stumped everybody on the Classics Corner, right?
Yeah,
I think so. I should give a shout out to someone was listening to the show. Her name is Rebecca H, and on Twitter, her name is Of Books and Bikes, and she guessed the correct answers last week. Before Ryder was able to get them both out, she was apparently very upset that you were not getting the answers out correctly quickly enough. She guessed them as soon as she heard them, and so we're sending Rebecca a prize. So if you guess ahead of Ryder or Julia, which will be difficult this time,
how are we going to judge
because
that?
Julia
though?
Gets it within one sentence.
Anybody can just say,
"We trust our listeners."
Yeah, you're right. We'll trust our listeners round.
Yeah, I'll. We'll send one of you a prize if you guess what it is right away. I don't know what that prize will be. It's usually a book or some other ephemera that I find in my house or a signed picture of Julia. So that was Classics Corner. Join us next time and we'll stump each other with some other dead Russian.
Sounds dirty.
Stump each other with a dead Russian. Sounds like the name of a great drink. I love a stump with a dead Russian.
Welcome back, everybody, from an arbitrary break where we didn't actually take a break, but where Julia went and got her power cord. This week, this episode, we're talking about a writer that we mentioned a couple episodes ago named Brees DJ Pancake. And he was more generally known as Brees Pancake. And his middle name was not DJ, it was Dexter. But he is a writer that I really feel like a lot of people don't know about anymore. And in fact, when I brought him up on the episode, whenever it was, some time ago, neither of you guys had heard of him, right?
Right.
No.
So I read him...
It was during the episode I went ahead and ordered the book.
Yeah.
So I had started reading it before we decided to do it as an episode.
So he's a writer that I first read in as an undergraduate. He killed himself in 1979, and a few of his short stories had appeared previous to his death in places like The Atlantic. And then after his death, they appeared more often in The Atlantic, and then a collection of his 12 stories, the stories of Brees DJ Pancake, which we're reading, was published in 1983 and was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. He only published 6 stories in his lifetime, so he was not widely known as a living writer. I think for a time in the late 1980s, mid to late 1980s, he was fairly well known, and I think for a little while in the 1990s, he was somewhat well known, and I think he's fallen off the radar for a lot of young readers and young writers, most likely, because you know what I had realized is that I'd never even had anyone read one of his stories in all the time that I've been teaching, which I thought was surprising because I would have, I should have given a bunch of people this book. He was born in West Virginia and lived there. He writes about West Virginia. I would say his work is probably most reminiscent for readers now, maybe of Daniel Woodrell in the regional dialects that he writes in. He's been compared to Hemingway. I think he has one of the most incredible and indelible voices ever, that no one else sounds quite like Brees Pancake. So there's 12 stories. We'll talk about a few of them as we go along, but I'm interested first to hear what you guys thought reading him for the first time.
I loved it. I mean, I was really intrigued. I mean, we've joked before about how, like, if it's a rural sort of coming-of-age thing, I'm on board. So the first couple stories, it was, like, a guy in his tractor, and, you know, I definitely love that vibe. I love the Faulkner. I love, I guess Willa Cather's not really a Southern writer, but I love people that write about, you know, rural communities and struggling with poverty in those communities, and it's great. I mean, it was funny because there's other authors I've read that have clearly been influenced by him.
Right.
That I didn't, you know, I never made. But I guess I expected it to be easier, like quicker to read. I was surprised at how even tempered it was, and how clear each one of his sentences are. You can't skip. You can't skim this book. And, you know, that's such a sign to me of a certain style of writing. And, once people say something like, oh, it reminds me of Hemingway, I think, oh, well, I can sort of skim through it or whatever. But it actually, it's really dense. He's an incredibly dense writer. And so the prose itself is really compact. So it's not like, as opposed to like Faulkner, who would write these, you know, one sentence long paragraphs, and you sort of get lost in the stream of consciousness. There's nothing like that. It's very tight and dense and just wonderful. It's a unique voice, and it makes me really sad that we don't get more of it.
Yeah, I was really struck by also, and I don't know if this is really true, because I mean, I write about killing people all the time, and I'm not gonna go out and kill anybody or kill myself, but there are some pretty obvious signs that this was a depressed person from what he was writing about. And in the afterwards and forewords to this book, and there's a great deal of scholarship on Brees Pancake that's out there, and a great deal of letters back and forth, people were surprised that he killed himself, and we'll talk about how he ended up killing himself in a bit, but everyone was seemingly surprised that he had suicidal tendencies and ended up shooting himself. But it's pretty apparent in the in what he was writing about that he was obsessed with those things, which makes it even sadder to read.
Well, I too loved it, and you know, I like the rural vibe too, but I think I'm more wary of it than you are, Ryder, of like, oh God, how cliche is this going to be, or am I going to appreciate this, you know, cerebrally, but not be affected by it because there's just so much out there like it. But what one of the things that I absolutely loved about this is just the really amazing, unique choice of character that so many of these narrators or characters were. Like, the one about the guy who operated the snowplow, I just, you know, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. You know, what is the life of a snowplower? And it that is outside, to me, that is a step beyond, you know, the tractor story that just thinks about, the, you know, the seasons and, you know, the emotions of these particular kind of jobs and experiences in a way that I've never experienced before, you know. And there's stories about really young prostitute or people living in men's homes. Well, that's the same story. But I just was so drawn into the different perspectives on this community. And I think that's why I really, really enjoyed it.
And there's a real question, I think, in the work about his portrayal of women. So I'm sort of interested in your feelings about that, Julia, because invariably, so even just in the first story, Trilobites, is that how you pronounce it?
Trilobites.
There is a rape that happens in this story. So I'm curious about how you feel just in general about his portrayal of women. My view is that I don't think he's not marginalizing women. I believe these are how the women were treated and how people acted towards them in this world, and that's what he wanted to show. But did you experience anything in the sense of most women in this are basic sex objects or whores or someone that you're going to get drunk and fight for? What was that like for you?
For me, it felt, if anything, the most of the shortcomings that I felt from this book, and especially that one, which did stand out to me, just come from being 26 years old and like just discovering your art. Like, I really, that's what's sad about this book is, like, I feel like the breadth of his talent to write was outpacing his breadth of experience and or the breadth of the subject matter that he chose to write about. So these stories actually work really well as a collection because they are all focused on sort of men in West Virginia or the South in sort of lower, you know, low working class drifters, men, you know, coal miners, truck drivers, that kind of position in the South. Like, that's his subject matter for these stories. I feel like had he lived a couple more years, he would have produced a novel about that would have had equally developed female characters, or just, I mean, the fact that you were, that he was 26, I mean, you think about where you were at when you were 26, to have the talent that he did as in terms of the vocabulary and ability to capture moments and to give life to characters that he probably didn't know all that well. He knew the world, but he might not, I mean, I don't know how many actual plow drivers he knew, but the fact that he was able to create, like you were saying, an incredible 5 or 6 page story that just draws you into this guy's world completely and believably, to me indicates that had he decided to expand that to include the people he didn't immediately know as well, like women or, you know, whatever he hadn't experienced yet, it's a loss. But I definitely, by the end of the book, I was like, oh, do I want to read another story about the farming life being lost and the new generation of people? You know, but, and when you think about it, like, Faulkner was obsessed with the generation, the post-Civil War generation, so he just kept writing about that, but he found a way to, you know, throughout his career to make it more interesting and include issues of race and sometimes, you know, women or, you know, whatever, it kept expanding. And I feel like had Pancake kept writing, it would have expanded in the same way because it clearly has a sensitivity to the humans he's writing about. It's just that he was still figuring out what to write about.
Well, there's this little bit in Trilobites right before the sex scene, actually, which I'll read, which actually kind of highlights what you're talking about his skill outpacing his own experience. He says, the main character's name is Collie, and he's with a girl named Ginny. And Ginny says to him, "What is it, Collie? Why can't we have any fun?" And he says, When I was a young punk, I tried to run away from home. I was walking through this meadow on the other side of the hill, and this shadow passed over me. I honest to God thought it was a pterodactyl. It was a damned airplane. I was so damn mad I came home. I peel chips of pain from the window frame, wait for her to talk. She leans against me, and I kiss her real deep. Her waist bunches in my hands. The skin of her neck is almost too white in the faded evening. I know she doesn't understand. In that paragraph, it's also basically explaining where he was as a writer, you know? He's 26, talking about being a young, in this character, talking about being a young punk. And, you know, when you're 26, you think you're older than God. You think you know everything, and you're still, you know, really just a kid. But I love that paragraph, because right after that, he basically rapes this girl. And he doesn't recognize that he's raping her. He's surprised when, at the end of it, she drives away and leaves him there. It's a moment of like that where there is such a mixture of innocence and being older than yourself as a writer, and then also the surprising violence that, you know, I just, that paragraph alone just makes me think, man, this is a guy who, if he had lived, could be doing anything right now. He could be the finest novelist in the world.
He's writing in a way that is thoughtful and detailed enough that seems like he is aware of the stereotypes he is creating and reflecting upon. I mean, we can't pretend we don't live in a world in which women weren't mistreated in many ways. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there's an accurate reflection of that world does not inherently make the author himself sexist.
No. And, you know, he apparently had lived hard. He was probably older than his 26 years. And if anything, what the foreword and the afterword say is that, you know, he'd seen some shit and he'd gone through some things. Which, you know, I wonder if I had read these stories without reading the foreword and the afterword again, because I hadn't read these stories in years, if I'd have the same opinion. Because once you sort of hear about the person and these people's memories of him, it changes the way you read the stories.
Well, like I said, I mean, I think they actually function really well as a collection. So, like, if you handed me these stories and I didn't know anything about the author, and you said this is a collection of short stories, I would probably really appreciate the thematic resonance and the repetitions. Like, you know, there is an ongoing theme or ongoing use of fossils and, like, natural, that, you know, things within the landscape that tell a story. Like, there's Indian burial grounds, there's dinosaurs referenced, like you talked about, there's actual fossils, there's talk about coal and where coal comes from. Then there's also lots of repetition of the use of animals, and, like, you know, there's bobcats and foxes, and sort of comparing animals attacking each other to humans, viciousness towards each other, and that sort of, like, you know, fighting for your place in the food chain versus fighting for your place in the social structure. And there's lots of things that come back, and, you know, and then, like, and then just the class issue, like, just the fact that these are all people of a certain class and they're all men. You know, there's a lot that I would have thought was more like, oh, wow, this is a really well-crafted use of these thematics to create one collection. But because I know he died at 26, I'm tempted to say instead that actually this was just where he was at. And this is all he could write about at this point, because that's all he had explored. So thematically, you know, he was still sort of... And so in a way, it's like it makes for a great collection. But because he's only 26, I find myself sort of judging the experience level and saying, oh, I wish there was more... I wish there, you know, could have expanded from beyond this world, which is in a way kind of unfair, because the truth is it completely works as a cohesive collection. Mm-hmm. It's not uplifting. It's not fun.
No.
It's certainly, like, kind of a drag. I mean, you meet these people at all the, you know, I mean, look, pretty much every story follows a similar arc, which is somebody who's really unhappy, a man who's really unhappy with their place in life. They're not fitting into the old social order, which is usually represented by farming or their father, a father figure of some sort who has a more like natural connection with the landscape. So they're not fitting into that, but they're also having a hard time with machines a lot. Like, they're not, you know, it's this car culture and they're not really fitting into that in some way. They're kind of miserable. They do something violent or, you know, awful in order to survive, in order to function. Women leave them. I mean, they're like country songs. Right. I mean, that's what we're listening to is like, you know, oh, I have to shoot my dog and drive off in my old beat up truck. Like, that really is what most of these are about. Like, and that's sort of how they end.
It's actually like a Drive By Truckers album, you know, like the Dirty South.
Yeah, it's a dirty, dirty Southern book. And that's so cool in some ways, but it's also, it isn't really lifting. Like, I got frustrated because and this is just more of a thing I think I'm going through. I'm a little over the short story. I'm really liking novels. And so I was frustrated by the short story factor. I would get into a character and into a world, and these are not easy reads. So I would get, it would take a while, you know, take a couple pages for me to be like, oh, the names, the cosmology of names to sort of fall into place and be like, oh, these are who these people are to each other. Now I get this guy and this girl and I see where they're going. And then the story would just end. And I'd be like, oh, I have to reset to read another story to, like, you know, put all this work into another character that's going to just depress me and leave. So I think like I'm a little over short stories right now. Ever in my entire life.
Well, you know,
so I feel like that's a little unfair, but
I'm over short stories. So fuck this guy.
Yeah, no, but you know what I'm saying? Like, if these are not, if they aren't satisfying, I mean, in a great way, they aren't satisfying. They are supposed to leave you with this lingering sense of, ooh, you know, this heavy angst about the world and the South and a mood. Yeah, they're really, and so that did get tiring to read in one sitting. Multiple stories would get very exhausting.
It's hard to see with a writer of this talent who's writing on such themes, if these would have been the themes of their lives, of his life, would he have always written about these rural environments, or could he have taken those amazing, beautiful skills and description and characters and created collections about wholly other things? I mean, you know, I want to see Brees Pancake fan fiction. It's just so wonderful and haunting and beautiful, but that's what we get when we only have one collection or one book from a writer. It'll bother me forever, you know. What if
these stories are sort of endemic of a time in short fiction also when people didn't write, well, people wrote them but no one published them, funny short stories. It's a combination of the sort of the gothic Southern style and then the dirty realists that were out at that time. But you know what I kept thinking about while reading it was two different modern short story collections, and it has to do with the portrayal of humans versus animals in rural settings. And that is our friend Megan Mayhew Bergman's Birds of a Lesser Paradise, and also a great book I read not too long ago by a short story writer named David James Poissant called The Heaven of Animals, which I reviewed somewhere, the LA Review of Books, where it's that strange battle that I think we are having now. And we talked about this generally when we talked about those essays, When Animals Attack, of our place in the modern world with the animal kingdom, and how the advancement of modernity has pushed the animal kingdom to its furthest reaches, and eventually they're going to want some of that fucking land back, and they're going to come, and they do come. So I'm fascinated by that intersection that's happening here, because these are all very rural short stories, except for A Room Forever, which takes place in a big city, but where the people in that story are animals. I'm sort of interested in that obsession about where we fit in the animal kingdom and why it tends to creep up in different times. Have you guys noticed that in other things that you've read?
Moby Dick. Now's the time. Read it. You know, it is. It's all about how we treat animals and how we exploit the animal kingdom and whether we should respect this mysterious, crazy whale animal. I mean, that to me is a huge part of that book, is the industrialization of an animal. It's such a crazy, and you know, and I mean, explicitly, it's an examination of what this animal means, and you learn so much about the sperm whale, even though I obviously didn't remember it when we brought it up last time. But you end up, you know, you should read Moby Dick, man, if you're into this. Now's the time, Todd. The use of animals in this book sort of bothered me. It felt a little heavy-handed and on the nose in some ways, and I don't know. Every time, you know, it was like a bobcat was watching him, I was like, really? Like, are we, you know, I wasn't feeling it that much. But I do, you know, squirrel hunting, like, that just is crazy to me when you're hunting squirrels to eat them. I mean, that was crazy in that movie, Winter's Bone, when they did that, too. It's just like, oh.
Right.
Like, wow, we're down to eating squirrels. So that's, you know, and then we describe, like, you know, field dressing a squirrel in this book is pretty intense.
Well, that's your problem. So that was Priest Pancakes.
Or getting whipped with a black snake. I don't ever want to be whipped by a snake. That sounds bad.
Well, I just read an awesome collection of short stories by George Saunders, 10th of December, just the other day. So I am not over it. And God, his stories were so hilarious and beautiful, and they have just such a strong sense of voice. And yeah, if anyone's looking for a short story collection, even if you've never read short stories at all before, or think you don't like them, or haven't read them since college or something, definitely check out 10th of December. Mm-hmm. And I am assigning that to you, Ryder, because you need it.
I love that scene in The Great Gatsby where he goes in his room and he starts throwing dogs. All these beautiful dogs! All these beautiful dogs!
Go read it!
I love that scene.
Hang up and go read 10th of December.
I kept thinking about how much this book felt like the 60s, 50s and 60s, and how different the South is now. Like, I'm very curious about, I haven't read any Woodrell's books, so I haven't read much contemporary Southern literature. Like, most of the stuff I've read.
Well, you saw Winter's Bone, and that's a Daniel Woodrell book. Yeah.
I guess I was fascinated by how unique these towns were. And I was thinking, like, nowadays they would just be McDonald's and Foster's Freeze or whatever, like, whereas back then it would be like the local diner where people would work and the boarding house, you know, where there's the woman that everyone knows is a whore. Like, I just wonder if that still exists, or if in these small towns are just sort of strip malls of big box stores now. Mm-hmm. And how different that culture, it's a different type of poverty and it's a different type of impoverishment, but it's, you know, and it's also probably like, even though, you know, these people are starving and shooting squirrels, like, I wonder, like,
what,
like, how are people surviving now in, like, really poor, dirty South situations? They're probably just buying McDonald's. Like what, how, you know, I don't know. I was just curious about, like, where the Southern, dirty Southern culture is at and who the writer is for that.
Well,
right,
I think,
now,
even if you listen to, like, someone like Jason Isbell, for instance, you know, who writes his songs a lot about these sort of small towns in the South. But David James Poisson, he, in his book, he writes a lot about these small towns in the South, but they're more like Florida and Louisiana. But, you know, the big boxerization, the Walmartization of small town America is a real thing. You know, that's the commerce. And so if you happen to drive through the South, or you drive through, you know, any parts of rural America, you know you're getting close to town when at the edge of town you see the giant Klieg lights and the huge, you know, Walmart store.
And that's what I wonder. I mean, doesn't that homogenize culture in a way that, like, I mean, part of the joy of reading this book is getting a glimpse into those lives that are, for most of America, kind of unimaginable. You know, like, oh, what is it like in West Virginia, coal mine town? You know, like, when you have to go on strike, but you know that that means, you know, certain people are not going to follow you, or, you know, whatever the conflicts are in this book, part of the fun is going, like, wow, of course I've, you know, there's an industry that exists that I've profited from as a consumer, but yeah, nowadays I just feel like it would just be reduced to people that work at Walmart or not. Like, there aren't these, you know, industries or these company towns like there used to be that figure in this, in a book like this. And everyone has a cell phone and internet access, so we're all sort of becoming of the same culture. Like, we all have the same cultural references and touchstones, and we're not engaging with the natural landscape that much.
To play devil's advocate for a second, I mean, I agree with you, Walmart is very depressing, but sharing one culture means we're starting to de-romanticize the idea of poverty. I mean, the poverty that's presented here, and even in Winter's Bone, does have an almost fairy tale magical aspect to it that takes us very far away from the day-to-day experience of living hand-to-mouth. Whereas, you know, I can imagine what it would be like to only eat McDonald's, and that's my personal hell. That's
just awful. I mean, and of course, there's many worse things that can happen, but the fact that we're sharing one culture does also give us the opportunity for more empathy and more active change, rather than these works seeming like they're from a time that is so far away that we don't know how to engage with them.
And I think the one story that really takes place in a town, which is A Room Forever, which is my favorite story actually in this book.
Me too. That's so funny that you said that. I was almost going to say that's my favorite story.
It's an intensely fucked up story.
Yeah.
But it takes place in town, and in town is just as dirty and just as and more awful than being in this small town America. So the basic story of A Room Forever is there's a guy who's about to ship out on the Del Mar, which is a boat, and it's New Year's and it's his last day in town before he ships out, and he goes and he picks up a hooker who is a 14-year-old girl. He has sex with her after having a brief conversation with her, which she finds unsatisfying. Then he goes to a bar. He sees the girl in the bar. He then walks outside, and the girl has gone outside and slit her wrists. I've shortened the story incredibly, but that's the basic premise of it. And it is just a really, for me, the reason why it's my favorite is that it pulls absolutely no punches. The hooker does not have a heart of gold. She does not want to be saved. That scene where he walks outside and he finds her there with her wrist cut, he doesn't try to save her. He comes inside the bar and tells the bartender, hey, there's a girl out back who slit her wrists. And then he keeps walking. Right. It's just absolutely brutal.
Brutal. Totally.
I think what I loved about that story so much was the way that he when he first sees the girl, he talks about her with such sympathy and understanding, mm-hmm. like, oh, she's 14 or 15. She had to have run away from home. She's not really ready for the life of being a prostitute.
Right.
And then proceeds to completely assist in her degradation. And, like, he is so delusional. I just mm-hmm. couldn't believe how self-deluding this guy was. And I thought that, like, going back to, you know, what we first talked about, like, that shows a sensitivity to women. Just that you would write a story about how a guy could be so self-delusional shows that Pancake was obviously thinking about, like, women in these ways, you know. Mm-hmm. He just wasn't writing from their perspective yet, but she is a really interesting character, and that story you're just so disturbed by the narrator. You're mm-hmm. so, like, with him, and then you're like, whoa, I don't know where this guy's coming from, and then it's like, oh, I loved it. I was chilling.
Yeah, it draws you in and pushes you right back out. I mean, that's what's great about these stories. You know, they're playing with empathy and your sympathy.
He has a great paragraph. He's in the bar, and he says, I look around. All these people have come down from their flops because there are no parties for them to go to. They are strangers who play a little pool or pinball, drink a little booze. All year, they grit their teeth. They pump gas and wait tables and screw chippies and bait queers, and they don't like any of it, but they know they are lucky to get it. Ooh, man. It's an amazing paragraph.
Oh, so good.
And it's powerfully sad and powerfully weird. And, you know, he does at least, he tries to redeem the character a little bit. He tells the girl that she could stay in his room for the next month while he's gone. And she says, shut the fuck up and pay me, or something like that.
That's part of what's so great about it, is that you almost get the feeling like he is kind of falling for her. Like, you know, he's mm-hmm. so desperate for human connection that he might try and, you know, but of course it'll never happen because they're both so
right.
fucked up. Oh, it's so good.
if you dream that you're in a bar filled with chippies, just pinch yourself. Yeah. You're not in a bar.
Yeah, it's gonna give me nightmares.
You know who I was reminded of? Have either of you read Chris Offutt?
Yes, very good writer.
Yeah. Chris Offutt is a really great contemporary writer who does a lot of rural Southern stuff. But I think most of his stuff is kind of periody, if I'm remembering mm-hmm. correctly. But he has a collection called Kentucky Straight. And then he has another collection, which I'm blanking on the name of, but he's a short story writer. I don't know if he's written novels. I've only read his short stories.
Well, the thing about Chris Offutt,
when we were at Bennington.
Chris Offutt stopped writing short stories and started writing TV shows. He wrote the first two seasons of True Blood. And then he also wrote...
Well, that's unfortunate.
Well, the first two seasons of True Blood were good.
No, they weren't.
I enjoyed them.
Keep going.
And then he had another show that he was doing. I don't know if it ended up getting picked up. It was about a family in Nashville, a musical family in Nashville.
That sounds awesome.
Oh, that's so cool. I have to
I saw the pilot of it, I think. At any rate. But, yeah, he's been working in TV for a while, for the last 10 years.
Some of his short stories are remarkable. And, like, the Kentucky Straight, I think they all take place in Kentucky, which is why it's called Kentucky Straight, mm-hmm. the name of the collection. But, you know, he just has these really weird characters. Like, he has, you know, people that live off of the land in the woods, hermits, and but similar to this in a lot of ways, a little less depressing, I think, ultimately. But really cool Southern stories.
And
if anybody is into this, they should definitely check that out.
Let's see. He grew up in a small former mining community located in the Appalachian Mountains. So a good comparison to Breese Pancake. The memoir is called No Heroes, A Memoir of Coming Home, and came out in 2002. Looks like he's also been writing for the TV show Weeds recently.
Well, Lord knows short stories aren't going to do it.
Yeah. You know, and I'm sure Breese Pancake's making more from his short stories now than he ever did. And I should note, Breese Pancake, and I didn't know this until this past week. I was talking about him on my Facebook page, wondering if anyone were still reading him. And apparently he has a niece named Anne Pancake, who is a short story writer and a novelist and teaches at an MFA program with our common friend Dinah Lenny. And so she writes about the same area in West Virginia, apparently. So I've ordered her book, Anne Pancake's book. It's a collection of stories, so I'll report back if it's good. If it's not good, I won't say a word, and you guys will never know the difference.
I'm curious. That's interesting.
But I'm sure it will be. So this was the stories of Breese DJ Pancake. It's a wonderful story collection by a writer who died too soon. No, we should mention briefly the weird case of his suicide. So he was found in a neighbor's house. They came home from grocery shopping and they found him sitting there, and he told the neighbor, "Oh, sometimes I get drunk and wander around." She ran out screaming. He ran back to his house. His mother, I think it was, came in and told him that the police wanted to come talk to him. They're on their way. He went outside, took a shotgun, and blew his head off. So it's a
really sad, well, mostly
terrible
because
story.
It sounds so much like one of his characters.
Yeah,
like it makes me think that he had an empathy with his own characters that went really deep, in a way that, you know, it's depressing because I would hate to feel like these characters.
Yeah, it's awfully depressing. But well worth the read. And for those of you who are creative writing students out there that are listening, if you're writing short stories, you don't know it, but every writer you've read in the last 20 years probably was influenced in some way by these stories, and they're absolutely worth the read. So it's the stories of Breese DJ Pancake, available in fine bookstores everywhere.
And that's it for this episode of Literary Disco. Join us in 2 weeks when we read Twice Upon a Time by Hari Kunzru, an essay that appears in The Atavist. Literary Disco is edited and produced and saved each week by Tucker Ives. Follow us on Twitter at Literary Disco. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/literarydisco. And thank you for listening.